I mean, and David, you know Madison, she doesn't make too many mistakes. And so when that window opens, you know, you want to let as much sunshine through as you can, you know.
That's what Curtis says, but I don't think it's true. So I think it's actually the case, though. I get teased a lot.
I've never seen Madison make a mistake, even as a classmate, so it's true.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Welcome to Forward, a TED's faculty podcast. I'm Felipe Deauville.
And I'm Madison Pierce.
So today we have the privilege of interviewing Dr. David C. Kirkpatrick, who is Assistant Professor of Religion at James Madison University. Dr. Kirkpatrick is a historian of religion, politics, and social movements, working at the intersection of Latin America and the United States. He has a fantastic book on Latin American evangelicals who demonstrated a vibrant concern for the ways the gospel must be shown to have intrinsic resources for caring for that for the poor. That book is this one here. It's called A Gospel for the Poor. I don't know if you can see the camera there. A Gospel for the Poor, Global Social Christianity and the Latin American Evangelical Left. He completed a PhD at the University of Edinburgh's prestigious Center for the Study of World Christianity, but not before passing his way through TEDS, earning an MDiv and an MA in Intercultural Studies. We're delighted to have him with us to learn about his work. Welcome to Forward, David.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be, I wish I was back in person, but it's great to be back in spirit at TEDS. We'll talk more about TEDS. I'm sure I can't hold back, but it's great to be back at a place that I believe so much in the mission and appreciate you both.
Oh, thanks, yeah. David. Well, we're going to start with a question that I anticipate is the most important for you, which is, what is your favorite thing about Wisconsin?
Mm.
Oh, wow. Is this what the whole theme of the podcast is? Because I think I'm going to need...
it's just a Wisconsin podcast. Yeah. You think we're talking about your book.
Yeah. Right.
We started out that way, but native Wisconsinite, David Kirkpatrick.
My goodness. Wisconsin, you know, it is the inspiration for everything I do. And that's a great question. I just think it's so beautiful. Honestly, I love the lakes. I love the culture. I love the people. I love cities like Milwaukee. That's more than one, but yeah. Wisconsin, I think I've actually tried to think of this before, but I think it's five or six generations of, certainly before Wisconsin was a state, my family was in Wisconsin. So lots of roots and everywhere I drive can see kind of, footprints of my ancestry. So that's a serious answer to, it was supposed to be a joke of a question, but
I knew you had a real answer.
So I live in Kenosha and, we are taking, so David Louie and I had a formation group up here and we both live in Kenosha. We're taking our formation group on a pilgrimage to the Cheese Castle.
Yes. Okay.
And I remember one of our students asked, they said, what's the Cheese Castle? And I was like, well,
come and see.
It does what it says on the tin. You know, it's a castle filled with cheese.
That's the path to my heart right there. Yeah.
Well, transitioning to that, you know, you're from Wisconsin, but can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up at TEDS, how you got to Edinburgh, and so on, a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I did my undergrad at the University of Wisconsin in Stevens Point, and I studied Spanish, which is kind of like, I'll come back around to that in my academic career as I did a lot of Spanish interviews and archival research for the book. But yeah, looking for seminaries, you know, I looked all over, I looked in the UK. Of course, I eventually went to the UK, but was really looking for a place that I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a pastor or I wanted to be a professor. And I wanted a place that took seriously both the academy and the church. And there's not that many places that can say that they do, but also do, and that can be taken seriously in both places as well, that the church, you know, I always felt like if I went to a place like TED, at the very least, I'd be a very good church member, I'd be able to lead Bible studies, to preach, and, you know, to be faithful to the text. And so I remember when I visited TED's campus, and I think this is a lot of people's stories, where I ran into John Woodbridge, and he invited me into his office and, you know, was really asking me questions about what I was gifted in and what, you know, what I was passionate about. And telling his stories about the history of American evangelicalism and how I might fit into that story was really, really captivating. And it's, I mean, it's pretty neat to look back. You know, I did very well in undergrad, you know, had a lot of options, and I would have chosen, I would choose TEDS again. And I just absolutely loved my experience, you know, not least because Madison was a classmate of mine. You know, that was a great experience. But, and even looking back now, you know, to think about how I'm able to, my wife and I lead a community group at church, and all the things that I learned about TEDS and the person that I became there as well, I think was fantastic. And so then I went off to the University of Edinburgh to do my PhD, which was a great experience at the Center for the Study of World Christianity. Brian Stanley, if you know him, and then the late Andrew Walls, had a lot of interaction with him. And David Bebbington was my external reader. So that was a wonderful experience, and we'll get more into the process of you know, beginning to write the book. Did your question get into the academic trajectory? Do I talk about postdoc stuff, or am I getting way ahead of myself?
I can follow up with that. Yeah. So I think that we can see some kernels of what your, or the trajectory of your work in some of those early moments that you shared with us, you know, doing Spanish or working on Spanish, and then even intercultural studies. So those kind of glimpses of what I knew about you at TEDS, which, yeah, we had a lot of classes together. But then how did you move into the research that you did at Edinburgh? And as another fun fact, David and I were in the UK together as well. And so we were able to keep in touch. So there were a lot of really special connections for us. So it's so wonderful to have you on here, David.
Thanks for having me, Madison. Yeah, and I think Madison and I have had a lot of conversations since then in terms of our growth, I think, as people and also as academics. And so it's been cool to see, I think, some of those things. Madison's been kind to me in my own, you know, journey toward maturity, you know, especially as a scholar. And so I just appreciate her friendship in lots of those conversations. And so, can you remind me of your question, Madison? Because I got distracted in terms of some of our conversation.
Being chums.
What was that?
Yes, exactly. No, thank you. And that generosity extends both ways, I hope. But yeah, I'd love to hear about how you ended up with this kind of research path, and how those kind of kernels in your early academic journey ended up in the book project, and those kind of interests came together, I guess.
Yeah. And TEDS had such a big part of that for me. You know, I came in as a student, and I think as a kind of stereotypical white suburban Christian, I went in thinking of my research project being something like Carl Henry. And again, great people, hero, you know, heroes of mine, Carl Henry or Ken Conser or, you know, somebody like that I was going to write my master's work on. I took classes with Peter Cha and was also a TA for him, who became one of my closest mentors. He introduced me to the work of Rene Padilla and others. But it really was also Doug Sweeney who, you know, it was fun. I was attending a Latino church at the time in Chicago, a Spanish speaking church. And I had just gotten back from doing some mission work in Latin America. I was reading Padilla and talking about that with Doug Sweeney. And he said to me, and it's kind of almost embarrassing that this had to happen as a master's student, but he said, David, you're fluent in Spanish. You're attending this church. You're passionate about Latin America. You know, all the questions that you're asking in terms of your own development around these things. Essentially, he was like, why are you thinking about studying the things that you're thinking of studying? Why don't you think about the Lausanne movement or Rene Padilla or, you know, and he said, and so that, meanwhile, this was while he's on sabbatical. He's making time for me, meeting together. We ended up designing an independent study class together. And so I was able to dive kind of full into Padilla, Escobar, Costas, you know, reading and kind of exploring whether or not that was something that I wanted to do. You know, Doug was also able to say, this is where publishing is moving. And I remember his point that was really tangible for me. He said, people like me wish we could learn more about Padilla. We wish we could learn from so much more of his work, but I can't read Spanish. Someone like you can be that bridge. And and so that was really a, you know, kind of an aha moment for me. I also remember where I was when I first started reading Rene Padilla and when he was critiquing things like the homogeneous unit principle, which we can talk about more later, critiquing issues of why white suburban people, being myself, read the Bible and don't see themes of justice and poverty and oppression. Why is it? And essentially him saying it's because you don't need it. I remember where I was sitting when I thought, he's writing about me. And why is that the case, that I don't see that in scripture? And so that whole journey became one of wanting to be a bridge to bring that story into more established discourses of you know, what's happening in the, in post-war evangelicalism, but also as kind of a reflection of my own, you know, journey that he had taught me so much. And so a lot of the highlights of writing the book was to be able to spend time with them and to learn from them, Escobar, Padilla, others, that we can get more into later. But Ted's played a huge role in opening my eyes to connecting my kind of personal life to my research life and kind of the skills that I had developed up till that point.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Well, it sounds like your biography testifies to the fact that the subject matter you ended up studying kind of gripped you. Kind of just seems like it chose you in a way. You know, you kind of, you know, all of the pieces came together and you ended up, and they came together in such a way that you're actually filling a gap in scholarship and so on. So that's really remarkable. That's really interesting. And yeah. I mean, I'm a Brazilian evangelical. And so when I saw your book, when I saw your interview in Yale, I was so excited. I was like, that's fantastic. Like, and it's work that, I mean, and Doug was right to point this out. It's work that hardly anybody's doing these days. And you point this out in your book really clearly. So maybe we can transition into asking you about that book. I mean, you tell a fascinating story of a group of people who are often overlooked. You know, a lot of maybe liberation theology, and particularly within Roman Catholicism, is really might be more familiar to folks. But the people you're describing are a different set of people, parallel to those developments. And they sometimes don't neatly fit into the categories that we have on offer, which I found really helpful as you started, you know, carving out space for them. So who are these people that you write about in your book, and what's their story?
Yeah,
thanks for that question. And that is part of the motivation, I think, in writing the book, is that when observers see anything that relates to social Christianity in Latin America, it almost always is at least framed by or referenced to liberation theology. So this is an evangelical form of liberation theology, or this is, you know, a response to liberation theology. It becomes the kind of orienting force. And what was exciting to me was to discover they weren't actually responding primarily to liberation theology, but to a shared set of social and political stimuli that's affecting Cold War Latin America. And so this is why the whole generation, and I'll talk more about who they are, of Pope Francis and Gustavo Gutierrez and of course Padilla, Escobar, others, why they are developing similar themes, because they're responding to the same context at a time when, of course, many people are talking about the contextuality of knowledge and this, you know, this the situatedness of all of our you know, our understandings of scripture. And so there's also these wider trends in reading of text that's happening. You know, primarily these are, and what's so interesting about their contribution is for Escobar and Padilla, they're staff members with the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, which is coming out of, you know, and not specifically coming out of Britain and the US, but out of national movements like InterVarsity, UCCF, the, you know, the student movements. Costas also is a missionary with the Latin America Mission, of course, after coming from TEDS, and he's been situated on university campuses too. And so when the Cuban Revolution happens in 59 and forward into the 60s, what's happening on college campuses is providing so many of the questions that's driving people like Gustavo Gutierrez and others, but also Padilla, Escobar, Costas. And so they're traveling across Latin America as campus ministers, and students are asking them questions like, to be a faithful Christian, do I need to pick up arms and take on this unjust government? And so they're looking at the resources that they have, and even they're turning to missionary friends and saying, how do I answer these questions? And they're being given resources that just have nothing to do with, you know, the relationship between capitalism and Marxism, or, you know, socialism, or the relationship between violence and social change. And so they're being driven by their own context of working with university students. It's university students that then are, you know, providing this energy. So they're staff workers, and they themselves are evangelical Christians. They want to be evangelicals. They want to change what evangelicalism is, and they don't want it to be, you know, I use the phrase evangelical left, and we'll get more into this, but they don't want it necessarily to be an evangelical left or evangelical right. They want this to be, this is who we are. This is what our mission is. This is how we read scripture. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting that they're all primarily, and even not primarily theologians, but they're primarily missionaries and campus ministers.
Yeah. That's really, really interesting, David, and I think there are a lot of different directions we could go. I would be interested. I know that TEDS does make an appearance in the book. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about how TEDS intersects with some of these stories, but also perhaps that could help you to situate some of what you're saying about the evangelical left and define it and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting place that it arrives is in the final chapter, where there's this debate between Al Mohler and Jim Wallace about what the mission of the church is, and is social action or social justice, you know, is that central to the mission of the church? And so, I mean, it does speak to TEDS that's a place where the debate happened, because I think it's a place where really the heart of evangelicalism is asking some of these questions about, you know, what is the mission of the church? And the kind of best of an evangelical critical biblical scholarship that's going to produce people like Padilla. So Padilla does his PhD with F.F. Bruce at the University of Manchester. And people like Brian Stanley say that Bruce is the leading conservative critical biblical scholar of the post-war era. But there's also, you know, the TEDS becomes this place where I hesitate to use the term refugee, but certainly academic refugees out of certain places are going to find an environment where they can ask these, probing questions about what evangelicalism is, and to share kind of the best of academia with, the evangelical world. So TEDS becomes this really interesting place. I think that a lot of this is going to play out primarily in global organizations like Lausanne. And so the Lausanne Congress of 74, TEDS is certainly going to have a lot of affinities with what comes out of Lausanne in terms of a truly globally connected evangelicalism, these networks that are, TEDS is so good at producing missionary leaders and, the leaders of kind of global organizations, where a lot of what we can get into more what Misión Integral is, but what kind of takes hold in global NGOs and in some of these mission organizations, that TEDS is going to certainly find a number of people who find affinity with that. Are there other things that you're thinking of, Madison, that I'm not thinking of TEDS as part of the story?
No, that's wonderful, David. It helps us to kind of orient ourselves. But I do wonder, I mean, I guess the conversation about the evangelical left goes back to the conversation about Jim Wallace and or that debate between Jim Wallace and Al Mohler. But can you say just more concretely for our listeners, how does that intersect with the concept of the evangelical left in your book?
Yeah, and I should say, I've had great conversations with Ruth Padilla Divorced. I was just at Wheaton in the fall giving their Billy Graham Center archival lecture, and she came, sat in the front row, and she's fantastic. She's such a wonderful person, and she disagreed with me publicly, and I obviously have no problem with it, about that term evangelical left, and wondered whether or not that fit, her dad. So I told her a story where, the audio tapes of Lausanne, which I spent a lot of time in, and Lausanne Congress was this gathering of Time magazine called it perhaps the widest ranging gathering of Christians ever held. Billy Graham Evangelistic Association funded leaders from all around the world to come and talk about the evangelization of the world. So Padilla was part of this breakout session on radical discipleship. And at this radical discipleship gathering, he used it as an opportunity to question whether or not US style democracy was what Latin America needed best. And use it as an opportunity to talk about socialist options for, the economy, talk about capitalism. And so that was one example I gave where I said, if you talk about politically, Padilla is going to be a fierce critic of American foreign policy. He's going to be a fierce critic of capitalism and globalization, its effect on the poor. He's going to be obviously a fierce critic of American leadership and American missionaries and, in some of these things. And so, and then where many of his colleagues land, Orlando Costa spends most of his career at Eastern Baptist Seminary, which is now Palmer, with people like Ron Sider. Of course, Samuel Escobar succeeds him with Ron Sider out there. And so, theologically, they're conservative. And yet on this, these questions about social engagement, these questions about political options, they're going to land more, left of the spectrum. And so, And Ruth has brought this up, when she was at Asbury, she brought it up as well about whether she likes that I, call them evangelical left. I think it is not a helpful moniker for gaining a wide audience for Misión Integral. I think they want it to be, mainstream. and yet kind of politically where they landed, they found themselves there. Also the kind of circles that they ran in, who was finding the kind of affinity with it. I closed the book with Brian McLaren, who I would not consider an evangelical anymore, but he certainly found a lot of affinity with it. Jim Wallace, Ron Sider, John Howard Yoder, who's now, mm-hmm. of course, disgraced, but you know, some of the conversation partners there with Anabaptists and Mennonites, mm-hmm. really what David Schwartz would situate as the evangelical left, they are going to be right alongside that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll say finally, what their main contribution is going to be is to ask this question about what is the gospel, and whether or not the gospel is, you know, has social dimensions, or whether or not social action is just an outworking of the gospel. And so where the pushback is going to be as well, which I think can tell us a lot about what kind of buttons you're pushing or where you're trying to push things, is going to come kind of right of the spectrum as well. And we can get into more of that, but the people who are going to not like it are people like Carl Henry and others who I think would be more on the conservative end.
Yeah. Oh, that's my really days. Helpful. I got so many questions.
I know.
This is why I got so excited reading your book, because in so many ways I was like, oh my gosh, I'm learning about my own institution. Mm-hmm. I mean, seeing Tetz crop up in the debate, but also seeing Orlando Costas as a grad, Jim Wallace, Sojourner started on campus, right? Is that right? I get that right?
Yeah.
Wow. So many interesting, but also Carl Henry's legacy and how those two streams maybe cross in some ways, but also don't in others. On page 14, I found this quote so stimulating. You ask the question, why is the evangelical left even considered evangelical? And the argument of your book, I thought, or one of the arguments of your book, is to say, well, they are evangelical if we are approaching their story from a particular lens. And, you know, they're rubbing elbows with people like John Stott, with Carl Henry, Billy Graham, etc. But you also find is that even if theologically they're perfectly aligned with these sort of like evangelical rock stars, nevertheless, their theological commitments are going to, if you ask them about how they work themselves out politically or socially, they're going to be rather different, which is not a question of whether your theological commitments work themselves out politically or socially, but it's how, right? And so what I find about these figures is so interesting is that they show that theological commitments and cultural commitments can sometimes swing free of one another. I mean, there's interesting, I know like Lydia Bean did a book on Canadian evangelicals and how their political commitments are totally, you know, they can be very different than how American evangelicals. So here's my question for you. You said they're concerned about what the gospel really is. That's what really made their heart beat. For somebody like Rene Padilla, for somebody like Samuel Escobar, and the whole vision of Misión Integral, what is the gospel for them? And what got them up in the morning and made them want to do the work they did?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, because I think understanding Padilla's contribution to this is also part of understanding his contribution as a whole, as a theologian, because this whole conversation on the contours of the gospel is one that has been given credit to people like John Stott. It's been given credit to people like Stearns, the head of World Vision up until a couple of years ago, who wrote a book, The Hole in the Gospel, you know, that whole conversation. And theologically, especially if you pay attention to the archival record, Padilla, and of course, especially those in the Anabaptist tradition, but Padilla is taking kind of a front leadership in this, in pushing that question. And so I argue in the book that others have been given credit for one of his main theological contributions. Mm-hmm. You know, and so when I say what the gospel is for Padilla, I think for evangelicals like those at TEDS, it sounds like, oh, of course, we hear that a lot. But at the time in the 70s, it was really controversial for him to say the gospel is good news for all of life. The gospel is good news for my neighbor. Of course, for this spiritual relationship with God, it's good news for creation. It is shalom, right? It is peace. It is the restoration of all things. And so I think when he's, you know, he talks about how and he picks on America. He says American evangelicalism wants the gospel to be like coming to a Robinson Crusoe on an island, and that doesn't have, you know, anything to do with one's relationship to neighbor, one's relationship to creation. But actually this good news is about, you know, is about the restoration, you know, of all things. And so Padilla does not want to shortchange the reality of the separation of people from God, the need for this spiritual reconciliation, but that the wholeness of the gospel has so much to do with the social realities too. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's, what's interesting is that's also where the pushback comes. People like Oliver Barclay, who is the head of the British Ivy University, wrote him, I believe this makes the book. It's so funny when you write a book and you want, you know, you have to read your own book to remember what you said, but Oliver Barclay writes him this personal letter and says, you know, I think what you're saying, so he says, you need to be aware, Padilla, that what you're saying is being misrepresented in the media. And he says, what's being said in the media is that you're saying that the gospel has social dimensions. I think what you're trying to say is that the gospel has social implications. And of course, what Padilla actually was saying was that it does have social dimensions. And he says to him, he says, you need to be really careful what you say. And you need to be really careful about how you're being represented. And this is like 2 weeks after Lausanne that he's getting these letters. And so where that pushback is coming from, it happens at Lausanne, and the audio tapes too, shows that this is kind of pushing the boundaries.
Yeah. Thanks, David. And I wonder, I mean, I know this is beyond what you might do in your work, but do you see some ways that that's connecting to our kind of modern day definitions of evangelicalism and the political dimensions that are kind of wrapped up in that?
Yeah. And I want to say, I mean, you brought up TEDS, you know, a couple of times. I think this is what makes TEDS such a great place, is because it does represent the breadth of the big tent of evangelicalism. And this is a place where these conversations take place, where it is not, you know, exclusively on like the right or on the left, but is the, you know, the whole tradition. And this, you know, I remember as a student, one of the reasons why I chose it was there was not a mold of where I was supposed to end up. I needed to be orthodox. And this is why I chose it. I wanted to trust the authority of scripture and be within what evangelicalism is theologically, but on the kind of what represents the breadth of evangelicalism, then I could have professors that were debating these things within themselves and, you know, and be able to be shaped with the mind of a scholar and the mind of a pastor. So I think that's why TEDS is such a special place, because especially in this environment, there's so much pressure to be on one side or the other and only allow certain voices to be in that conversation. So I think that's what makes it such a special place. I usually don't lose track of questions, but I think I'm so excited about the topic that I'm like, so can you remind me of what that question was?
No, you're doing a wonderful job. Yeah, we're just connecting it to some of these like modern day definitions of evangelicalism. But I think what you've done is to say that something broader is our hope here at TEDS. And that I think represents a lot of the work that you've done as well.
Yeah. And this is what's interesting, I think, is that too many generations want, and we talk about this a lot, where people want to come to questions fresh and act like they're the only ones who have engaged with, you know, questions of race or questions of social justice. And that, you know, this generation saying, oh, well, you know, even the kind of hand-wringing over Black Lives Matter of, you know, what do we do with this? How do we respond to this? What's been frustrating for me as a historian is that these are not new questions for evangelicals. And they're not new questions for American evangelicals. And so we need to draw from the strength of our tradition of, these have been soul searching moments for evangelicals across the world, of kind of the US with the global South. And even if you just want to study people like John Stott or Billy Graham or others, they wrestled with these at their core. Yeah. And so we need to learn from the ways that these questions have been asked and these questions have been answered. Even if you look at the history of like InterVarsity, for example, and the issues that they faced with the Urbana Conference in the 70s, issues of race and inclusion, of how to deal with this question of what is the mission of the church when political, you know, pull is so strong. So I think, you know, a friend of mine, Todd Harch, he wrote a great book called The Rebirth of Latin American Christianity. And he concludes the book by saying, Protestants need to read Catholic social Christianity to learn from these, because we have a long history of answering these questions. I agree and disagree. I think that absolutely Protestants need to read more Catholic social Christianity. The social Christian tradition of the Catholic Church is one that there's so much to learn from. But evangelicals need to learn from their own tradition so much more. And there's so many more resources that need to be, used as the rich resource that it is, the global conversation that it is, because I think evangelicalism's strength is that it is a truly global conversation. And too many times we're an island asking, you know, what are the answers to this question when there have been good ones, you know, given already.
Oh, that is so good. Yeah. When I was doing my PhD, an esteemed scholar once looked at me straight in the eyes and he said, "Know the wealth of your resources." And that's what I love about your work, is that I felt like when I was reading it, that I was learning afresh the wealth of my resources and the tradition that I inhabit. So it's remarkably good. It's remarkably good. Maybe I can pivot a little bit. I mean, I could go all day, but seriously, just go read the book.
Please, everybody.
Thanks.
But you are serving in a public university, James Madison University. And that's pretty cool. Not too many TEDS grads do that, right? Tell us a little bit about how you understand your calling to the academy in a public university. What do you enjoy about serving in a research university? How you understand your work as a historian within that context? Yeah. However you want to take that.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I mean, so I should note, no one's asked me to say positive things about TEDS, and nobody's, you know, I'm not a paid contributor.
But it is, we'll Venmo you later.
Exactly. This has been some of the cool part about I think why I've appreciated TEDS is because it's given me such a confident posture toward the academy where, I mean, I remember conversations with Doug Sweeney where I remember saying to him, as I was thinking about the job market and things and saying, you know, I have probably cut off my ability to teach at a public university or, you know, whatever, because I went to TEDS. And Doug was like, "No, you haven't." And was like, you know, that's just not true. And of course, you know, I think no one has a common path towards like tenure track jobs in public universities right now. Obviously I think, there are probably more TEDS grads in these places than I think that people realize, but I just appreciate that has been, not a surprising thing in terms of the trajectory. I absolutely love JMU. It's a fantastic place to work. And one of the things I like about teaching in a public university is you can be yourself as long as you're doing good research. And I love being a historian. I love the ability to write and research about, you know, what I want to teach on. And what's cool is that a lot of my upper level students, which is when I teach things like, I'm teaching one class right now called Christianity in Global Context. And most of my students are in Young Life, Crew, and InterVarsity, and they're really wrestling with a lot of the questions that, you know, we're reading people like John Gatu and Kwame Badiako and Padilla and others. Most of our syllabus is thinkers from the Global South. And the questions that they're asking are questions that students really want to wrestle with. And I get to, you know, this was last time I taught this class, but a student who was about to go after the semester to be a missionary in Africa. And they'd be able to say, "All right, so this author's saying there we should have a moratorium on missionaries. What do you think about that? You're thinking about going as a white American. How do you wrestle with that? What do you think about evangelization? What do you think about evangelism? Do you think this is ethical?" And students are not giving simple answers and are really asking tough questions about being a Christian in the modern world and the issues of kind of social engagement and social justice. That's this generation as well, where they really want to wrestle with issues of diversity and inclusion. They want to wrestle with the church and its response to, you know, racialization in the US. And I taught a class last semester that I called the Global Civil Rights Movement. So civil rights movement kind of in global perspective. And so that was probably my favorite class I've ever taught, maybe because I designed it from scratch, but it was super fun. And students getting into the archival record and getting into the personal papers of Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, King, you know, Stokely Carmichael and others, and really wrestling with the role of religion in social movements. And I love then to take on, why is it that these stories, you know, when we read Fannie Lou Hamer and she's, you know, coming back from getting, you know, violated in prison and being brutalized, and she's singing, you know, about her friendship with Jesus, you know, and she's sitting, you know, and just this amazing, vibrant faith. And I ask my students, I say, why haven't you heard this story as a story of like a hero story of the faith? I said, I never heard a story like this growing up, that this was on par with Jim Elliot, you know, or some missionary story. Why is it that you haven't heard these questions or these stories as kind of heroes? Those are the kind of questions that I like to raise in class, and they're extra fun, I think, in a context where students aren't expecting to be able to ask those questions in a public university. So I guess that's what I say. I mean, I think my colleagues are all over the map on faith and no faith, and yet they take me seriously and they let me be myself. And I love to be able to raise those conversations in class.
That's beautiful, David. Thank you so much. And we're really thankful. I mean, I think that it's a testament to who you are that you're able to serve in that context and to honor all the people that, you know, come into your classroom and that serve with you in the department and everything. So we're really proud to have you in the TEDS family for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like this might be the most like four of forward that we've ever, like, this is just a forward, but like it's really just a forward. Like, honestly, go and pick up David's book because it, I mean, if it, like what the conversation we just had just gives a wonderful glimpse at the kind of stuff he's doing. And if you're interested, not in simplistic answers to difficult questions, but in appreciating complexity, inheriting a rich tradition, asking difficult questions with sensitivity and nuance. I mean, he's both writing about people who demonstrated that, but also demonstrating it himself in his writing. And so the book is Gospel for the Poor, Global Social Christianity in the Latin American Evangelical Left. But yeah, just a forward. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. David Kirkpatrick, do check out his book. Keep an eye out for two forthcoming books as well, right? Blood and Borders, Violence and Intolerance at the Intersection of Latin America and the United States. I mean, do you want to say a word about that? That sounds fantastic. I mean, what's going on there?
Yeah, thanks. So that's due, well, my own personal deadline in the fall with Oxford.
Okay.
And that was fun. It came out of archival research where I kept kind of another folder of violence against missionaries and then the perception of Latin America and the US. So the book is really trying to grapple with how violence in Latin America, violence against missionaries shaped American evangelicalism as they looked across the border and as they kind of perceived Latin America. So it grapples with Latin America as a region and the stereotypes that arise of that. And then how this idea of violence helped shape American evangelicalism into what it is. So stories that are well known, like the Ecuador martyrs who were killed in Jim Elliott, Nate Saint Fleming, and others, as well as lots of stories that people are not as aware of that were circulating in prayer letters and sermons and on Billy Graham's Hour of Decision radio broadcast. So the chapters I'm most proud of are a chapter on JFK and Billy Graham with Colombian violence. So that's going to be exciting. Hopefully I can finish it by this fall. And then you mentioned, I'm doing an edited volume that's coming out, that is now in proof with Jason Bruner, who's a historian at Arizona State. And that is called Global Visions of Violence. It's all kind of how violence has shaped the construction of world Christianity, as a whole. Yeah. So pretty excited about both of those. Thanks.
Wow. Congratulations, David.
Yeah. Keep an eye out. Yeah. So check out those books. Check out his current book. Sounds like go take a class with him at JMU. I mean, I might go do that myself at this point. So thank you so much, David, for joining us. Yes. It was a wonderful privilege. We'd like to take a moment to thank the producer than which none greater can be conceived, Curtis Pierce, and then the platonic form of graduate assistants, Lauren Januzik. And certainly, last but not least, thank you, listeners and viewers, for joining us. I'm Felipe Dovale.
And I'm Madison Pierce. Thank you, David.
Thanks for having me. What a pleasure.
Forward is a podcast hosted by faculty at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. The views expressed by the hosts and guests of Forward do not necessarily represent the views of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. You can subscribe to our newest episode on your preferred podcast app or at forwardpodcast.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Forward Podcast to get updates and additional links to content. Trinity Evangelical Divinity School is located 25 miles north of Chicago, with extension sites across the country and online. Trinity educates men and women to engage in God's redemptive work in the world by cultivating academic excellence, Christian faithfulness, and lifelong learning. You can find more information at teds.edu.